Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Well, if you're like me, you're paying a little more attention to the birds in your area these days. We'll be talking more about those birds and about nesting with our guest. Bill Volkert back with us, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years, has been watching birds for well over 40 years. So have you been watching a nest in your yard? What questions do you have about maybe feeding hummingbirds or orioles? Join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email or a photo to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always nice to join you again last time around. Sorry we can't do it in person, but we'll get this to work.
Yeah, we'll get it to work for sure. I was talking to my IT, Mark, our IT person in my Department of Life Sciences Communication, and he's been walking on a path, and he said the other day he had a bird crack him right on top of the head. Nail him a little bit, and I said, oh, there's a nest nearby.
Exactly, yes. The more common ones to be that aggressive. Robins will do that, especially if they're, say, nesting right by your porch. And if you're outside, especially near a marsh or tall grasses, red-winged blackbirds, the males can be quite aggressive.
Yeah, so this was a blackbird.
The more common ones that will, yeah, they'll actually attack people. And you'll oftentimes see red-winged blackbirds chasing other birds, such as any hawks nearby, even if they're not a threat, crows flying nearby, which are a potential nest predator. Yeah, they'll be quite aggressive, so that the males will attack, and even people if they think they're getting too close.
Yeah, you know, it's a busy time of the year for the birds, for the nesting birds.
Yes, it is. Yes, this is the height of the summer, height of the nesting season, and also what I refer to as the fledging season, which is the time of year that the birds are leaving the nest. And for songbirds, there's always this period where the young are out of the nest but still dependent on the parents. The nest can be a very vulnerable site, so as soon as they're big enough, they jump. They're not going to return there again, but they'll be then moving among the dense foliage, and the parents will be looking for food, teaching them their skills, and helping to move on independently. Some birds are actually starting a second family. Bluebirds will. Robins will certainly attempt the nest more than once. And here by my home, I've got eastern phoebes that are back on the nest again. They're young, have been raised up, are independent, and they're starting a second family. But that's actually a little unusual because most of our songbirds only raise one family, only get one crack at it, and then it's time to return to the tropics. Of course, they don't nest down there. So this is really their one and only chance to raise a family, and we've got to be able to provide for them.
Why don't they nest in the south?
Well, the biggest thing is why they even come here in the first place, which is competition. two main reasons. First of all, you've got this incredible abundance of species as you get into the tropics. So there's that many more kinds of birds and a high density of birds. And on top of that, when you're raising a family, you now multiply the number of birds and put a demand on the food supply. And one other reason is that if you look just at a map, the tropical areas, while they are incredibly rich, are also by area much smaller. Think of just Central America, yeah. South America, compared to all of U.S. and Canada. And so we've got the nesting space, but it's only seasonally available, which is exactly why the birds fly up here, find a place, raise a family, and then retreat when the weather turns on them and the food supply diminishes.
Yeah. Claire in Menominee Falls has a question for you. Let's go there. Claire, hi.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Bill. I'm very happy to be able to ask you a question instead of emails. As you know, through my emails with you, I'm a beginning birder, and I'm trying to understand these questions, discussions about spring bird migration and changes of the weather, climate change, how just looking at Wisconsin, how that can affect the birds, and then also with the time that they're nesting.
Oh, good questions. This is still somewhat initial studies, and really to get an understanding of trends, we're going to have to look more long-term. Every year is a little different with the weather. but certainly there are the trends of things are changing. The amount of ice on lakes is getting shorter by almost a month. Spring is coming a little earlier in many years. And studies in Europe indicate that with that early spring, the insects may be hatching out sooner, but yet birds are timed not by the weather, but by the day length. So they're pretty well set on a calendar, which always worked for them when the climates were more stable. And so they may be arriving a little bit after that initial peak hatch of insects, which is important for the egg development and, of course, feeding the young when they hatch. The other problem also is that as there's more heat in the atmosphere, storms become a little bit more turbulent, and we have some more catastrophic events. And, of course, that means when birds are nesting, things get blown down, young get tossed, and that also can lead to some increased mortality on a very local scale.
All right. Claire, thank you so much. Tom in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys. Good to talk to you. I have a couple of brush piles in my yard from, you know, when I was taking down my ash trees. Well, I've had some wrens set up housekeeping in there. And I just was wondering, I don't want to, like, burn the brush piles with the wrens in there. Right. How long will they be in there?
House wrens are primarily cavity nesters. So I don't know if they're actually nesting. They may find enough of a nook in there that might work for them. They'll make a nest of tiny twigs. So if you've got, like I say, a bluebird box, they'll just pack that thing full. And they'll raise oftentimes two families in a year. I've got wrens right now that are working on a second nest. What I would do is they actually have a very short incubation period. It's only like 10, 11 days once all the eggs are laid. But yeah, if you would wait, say, till the third week of July or certainly the beginning of August, at that point, everything should pretty well be done. You're pretty well past the nesting season. Because if you think of it, the time it still takes to fledge the young, to get them to be independent and get ready for migration, it's getting pretty late in the season. For example, with ducks, they'll only raise one family in a year. If they lose a nest, they'll try again. But by the time we're getting into even this time of year, because they have a longer incubation period, it's getting a little late for them. Oftentimes birds are sort of the last effort right now on a second brood or a re-nesting if they lost the nest. So give it another month. In fact, that's the general guideline even for upland nesting birds in the grasslands. If you can avoid mowing your hay until the 1st of August, birds should be out, the young should be independent, and we're past that real nesting season.
All right, Tom, thank you so much. Jeff in Grand Marsh, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
I got a question. This weekend I was trimming up a tree that I knew had a robin's nest in it. Mm-hmm. And while I'm trimming and shaking the tree a wee bit, all three of the fledglings jumped out. They could not fly. Mm-hmm. And it took a bit. It was kind of like herding kittens. I managed to get all three of them back in there and stayed. And I left the tree alone. And I went back out the next morning, and all three of them were gone.
Right.
And I'm just curious. Is that because I had gotten in there and disturbed the nest so much that the parents talked them into leaving home, or what?
Well, I hate to blame you for it, but what they're probably, they're getting close to fledging. They probably would have preferred another couple of days to develop their flight feathers and be able to get around, even if it's just a little bit from branch to branch. But if they feel that nest isn't safe, it's better to bail out of there, because they figure now they've been discovered. So, you know, nests are supposedly secure and well hidden and nicely camouflaged from potential predators. But, you know, they oftentimes will get destroyed either when the eggs are in or even the nestlings be taken by predators. Or in this case, when they're getting close to fledging, they may jump the coop, so to speak, a little prematurely. But the main thing is if you can keep them off the ground, especially young birds, if they can't fly and they don't want to stay in the nest, if you see them on the ground, just pick them up, put them in a branch in somewhat of a secure area with a little bit of cover. They can climb around and maybe jump from branch to branch, and they're less vulnerable to any predators if they're off the ground. And with their chirping and peeping, the parents will find them. Just leave them alone. Do not try to intervene. Don't try to take them in. The parents will take care of them a lot better than you and I ever could. So that's the best you can do.
Good luck, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too, with question or comment. We've had some great ones so far. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Margie in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I have three little Phoebes that were blown out of their nests in this last storm that we had. And I've been watching Mom and Dad feed them straight ahead, but they're on the deck. And we have raccoons. And I'm not sure if I should try to find their nest and put them back into it. It's kind of like the last gentleman who wasn't sure what to do with his robins. They're not ready to fledge. They're all fuzzy and furry. They have a little bit of wing starting on mm-hmm. but that's it. So
well, the nest has been blown down. I don't know if you can get them back in there or if they'll even take to the nest. But as I mentioned with the previous caller, just get them off the ground. If they're up on the branches, they're going to be a lot safer up there. And as you say, the parents are feeding them, taking good care of them. And these young birds, they've got a high metabolism, and they really do develop quickly. A couple more days, and they'll be a little bit more capable of flying around. And within a couple of weeks of some good parental care, they'll be getting on their own. So, yeah, get them off the deck so that any predators are not able to reach them. Okay.
All right, Margie, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Jimmy and Mazamani, on to you now. Hi, Jimmy.
Good morning. Just curious, about a week ago, I noticed the songbirds freaking out, and I looked up, and there's a young eagle perched probably about 20 yards up in a tree. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it, and of course, the songbirds were getting angry, and what was interesting, the most aggressive were the Orioles. They were actually attacking the head of the young eagle. But I guess my bigger question is, I've seen it every day for about the last week around the property, around the perimeter of my prairie, and I'm wondering the sex or the reasoning that it's sticking around. Is it trying to set up shop in this area, or just curious of did it just leave the nest or get pushed out after the new ones came this year?
Got a good source of food there, right, Jimmy?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, for bald eagles, they, of course, don't get that white head and tail until they're about, say, 4 or 5 years old. And if you look at a good field guide that shows some of the immature plumages, the amount of white and speckling of white in the wing, in particular the underwing, and part of the belly, that changes with each year of life. And so if it's a bird from last year, it didn't get pushed out. It just migrated back here to its homeland, is just hanging out as a non-breeder, and it may do that for several years before it's old enough to actually begin mating. So, you know, one way or another, it's not old enough to breed. He's just sort of hanging out. And also interesting, in the same way that red-winged blackbirds will chase after red-tailed hawks, red-tailed hawks and bald eagles are not predators of birds. However, the birds just aren't going to take a chance. They're going to be aggressive no matter what. In the same way that, as Larry said, his IT man was certainly not a threat to the red-winged blackbird, but they're not going to sit around and wait and ask questions. So, yeah, they're going to be quite aggressive oftentimes.
There you go, Jimmy. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us and great to have you listening in. Join in at 800-642-1234. Or if you got a photo or a question, you can also email it to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Sounds like a robin to me. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Bill Volkert, our guest today, and we've been talking a little bit about robins here on the show. Bill, that's a nice sound to hear.
Yes, and that's probably one of the more common of the robin vocalizations. Some people describe it as cheerio, cheerio, a sort of a rolling little a gurgle, little whistle or a song to it. It is a member of the thrush family and certainly the most common thrush that we have. And it actually has a very nice song, though, you know, we hear it so commonly, I think sometimes people pass it over. The one thing you'll notice, if you really start to tune into something as common as a robin and start listening to it, they have an incredible vocal repertoire. They have just a variety of variations of their songs and a whole variety of calls that they'll give to contact each other for warnings, for alert calls, things like that. So like a lot of birds, they'll make many different sounds. And if you start listening to them, you're going to hear that they really have a complex vocabulary.
Yeah. Tyler, have you got that one up again? Let's play that American Robin once more.
Kind of
hear that cheerio.
Yeah. That's a common mnemonic, a little reminder, a little phrase that we use to put to it to help us remember what bird is saying what.
Marty in Dubuque has a question, I believe. Marty, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had actually one quick question and a second question I wanted to ask. First was, should you clean out bird boxes if you provide them to in your yard after the birds are done nesting, like chickadees and sparrows?
Good question. There's two ideas on this one. One is you may want to clean it out, particularly if you have parasites in there, like the blowflies that may move to the bottom of the nest and then come up to feed on the nestlings at night. If you're seeing any signs of that, yes, clean out the nesting material. Other birds, well, they will, in nature, find a cavity, build their nest, raise a family, and then try again, so they don't clean it out. But certainly clean it out at the end of the year, which removes the nesting material, any potential nest parasites, and you know, have them start over again the next season with that. So,
okay.
Yeah, there's kind of two thoughts on that one, whether we should or not.
There you go, Marty. Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask that second question?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Well, I had a really bizarre experience happen this year for the first time ever. And what happened was the hawks that live in my area were attacking a baby robin that had clearly just fledged. And it was terrible, and I didn't know what to do about it. I couldn't believe my eyes. And the parents were going crazy.
Well, that's interesting, because usually robins are nesting a little high off the ground for a predator like that. But robins, the one good thing for them is, and I had some here this year that built in an incredibly open, obvious place, and the blue jays were just right on that, and you could see the eggs were gone within a day or two. But they will try over and over and over again. I think probably the most vulnerable ones are the first-time nesters, the young from last year. And they oftentimes do not claim the primary territories with the best cover and habitat. And with the lack of experience, they figure, well, this is good enough. This will work. And it may or may not for them. So they learn with experience, too.
There you go, Marty. Thank you for calling. Steve in Little Suamico, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, gentlemen. I thoroughly enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I've got a comment and a question. We are north of Green Bay in the woods. We've had a month and a half ago, we had a hen mallard with 9 ducklings. 2 weeks ago, we had a wood duck with 5 ducklings. And yesterday, we had a hooded merganser with 3.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a good bird year for us.
Yeah.
The woodpeckers have been absolutely amazing. And we had a pair of pileateds about 50 yards from the corner of the house that built a hole, got everything all set up. We're incubating the eggs, and something predated them. What would be brave enough to go in a hole with a 5-inch beak coming at them?
My guess would be raccoon. They're one of the more common nest predators of wood ducks. They will climb in the trees to get up there and reach in, and they may also attempt that with something like a woodpecker. Yeah, if there's a meal for them, they'll get quite bold in that way. And oftentimes the parents, as soon as they realize there's danger, they'll abandon that nest to save themselves. And of course, that sounds quite selfish, but they always have a chance to nest again if they can survive. In the same way, say, Canada geese, when we have them walking around with their young, I'd always caution people as we came upon a family, let them move to the water, because if you rush them, the young will scatter in every direction. And those that go the wrong way, the parents will just simply hope that they find their way back. They're not going back to save them, because to do that is to risk themselves. So again, it's a little bit selfish, but you know, they can raise a family every year. And as I used to tell people, you know, because they are so prolific, they can, you know, essentially allow a few of those losses, save themselves for the next season. Larger animals are much more protective of their young because of the low reproductive rate. So, you know, for us, we don't take a whole group of school kids across the street and say, wow, we're lucky, we only lost one. You know, we're much more protective because of the high investment in that young and the long time to raise it, just like, say, elephants and other large mammals. But you look at Canada geese, once they mature, they'll have a good-sized family every year, and they'll accept those losses. So the same way, I think that woodpecker bailed on there just to save himself, and hope that the danger had passed. If it lost its nest, try again.
Yeah, there you go, Steve. Thank you. Sandy in Colby, it's your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi there. I have a little bird that is singing at night, driving me crazy, actually. We hear it during the day as well. I have not seen it. My husband said it's a little brown bird that sits on the tall grass. I have a video recording of it. If I play it for you, you think you can get a stab at what it might be?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give a listen. Let's see how this works through the phone. Mm-hmm.
So that was 20 seconds. Could you hear it?
I was just hearing a little, like a chuck, chuck.
Chirp, 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 chirp. And they echo each other.
Oh.
During the night.
Rhythm, okay, the rhythm that you're describing, if it has a little bit of a twangy type of a chatter to it,
yes.
If it's in tall grasses, my guess would be sedrin. And sedrins will call into the evening and sometimes, you know, after dark, or if we're doing bird surveys before the sun's even up, they'll be out there chattering away. It's a tiny wren. It's barely the size of a house wren. They love tall grasses, sometimes upland grasses or in lowland fields. And they'll make a bald nest out of grasses, which will be above the ground. That would be my guess. The other one that calls in the evening, which is in the marshes, is a swamp sparrow. He has a real rapid, just a series of chatters, just a chip, 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 chip. But as you're saying, chip, 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 that kind of a rhythm.
Yes.
Yeah, sedrin has that. And there's, like, to my ear, there's a little like twanginess to the chatter of it. I don't know how to describe it otherwise, but that's how I kind of remember it, the rhythm and that quality of the voice.
Maybe Tyler can pull up a sedrin for us.
Yeah, there's a good one. Yeah, I'll play it back and see if we can verify that.
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
S-E-D-G-E, sedrin.
Sedrin, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's it.
there you go. Okay. We got
there
that
you
one.
Go.
Thank you. They're really nocturnal. I mean, at 2 in the morning, they're still singing here.
Yeah, they're kind of insomniacs, aren't they?
They're annoying.
Well, I'll give them a little bit of while here. We're winding down with that nesting season. He'll give up eventually. And I wonder if this isn't perhaps a bird that hasn't found a mate, as an unmated male out there is still calling, hoping this season he might yet land a mate, then come back next year and be a little more successful.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Sandy, thank you very much for calling. Barb in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Oh, hi, Larry. Yeah, I'm calling because in late April, I was going for a walk in the late afternoon, And up high in a tree, there was a bird that was gray and white. At least it looked kind of muted. And rather than having a song, it had more of a vibration for its vocalization. And it sounded something like... And its whole body would sort of jump when it was doing that vocalization. Does that sound like anything?
Gray and white.
How big was it?
Yeah.
You know, it was way up high in the branches, but it looked like it was at least, 6 or 7 inches.
Robin size, okay. Maybe?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, he was just vertical on the branch, but just had this low vibrating sound, and his whole little chest would puff up, and he would just sort of bounce on the branch, and then with that, like that, and it just seemed sort of, not a songbird song at all.
I'll roll that around the back of my mind, or maybe another caller out there may have a suggestion as well. Let's see if we can come up with something. I've mentioned this in the past. One of the real problems in trying to describe a bird sound is that you're describing the pattern of it, but it's also the quality of the voice, and we just can't imitate what the birds do. It's really difficult that way. So I'll keep it in the back of my head. Let's see if I come up with something, or maybe somebody else can help us out.
Yeah, maybe we can get email us at ideas@wpr.org and let us know if you've got an idea about it. I'm racking my brains, not coming
Nothing
up with
comes
anything
to mind right now, but we got a little time.
We got some time. Pat in Edgerton, in the meantime, we'll go to you. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Say, I was wondering if anybody else has spotted an acorn woodpecker in Wisconsin so far this spring.
Acorn woodpeckers are common in the southern United States, primarily, say, from Texas and going west, and more the southern and western part of the U.S. It's somewhat almost, I'd say, the counterpart of our red-headed woodpecker. They'll go from there all the way into Central America. There's populations in the pine forests of Central America as well. They tend not to fly that far. They're not migratory. But we had a number of years ago Lewis's woodpecker, which is a western woodpecker in Wisconsin. I was sighted at La Crosse. So some of these birds may get off course. I don't know if there's any records for acorn woodpecker for Wisconsin. But I think the closest for that would be the redheaded, which is always a good sighting. They're not that common in most of the states.
It might have come up on the, what was that, hurricane winds that made it all the way up to Wisconsin?
Maybe. Right. And that's what we'll find is those big storms that are coming up from the Gulf and bringing that moisture here. In fact, Jill shared a photo that somebody had sent of a sooty tern that showed up, a bird that also shouldn't be anywhere near Wisconsin. They're down in the Caribbean and over to the Pacific. But birds will get caught up in those winds. And I always remind people that when you look at the weather maps, I don't mean to say that a bird is whirling around right near the eye of a hurricane and flying up here, but those storm systems are sometimes hundreds of miles across. And so they get caught up in those outer winds. They figure, hey, things are going great. You know, I'm making good time. All of a sudden they end up somewhere way off course. And so that's always what's interesting in watching birds and looking for the records of people who've got their eyes open. Is we watch for the normal trends and then these exceptions of things that get way off course. So you never know what may show up anywhere.
Should Pat be reporting that on eBird or someplace?
Yes, post on eBird. Also, if you look at the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the website wsobirds.org, there is a exceptional species reporting form there. So they'll have you document what you saw, and there's a couple of questions of, you know, what did you actually see, when, where, describe the bird, how far away were you, and compare it to other similar species that it could not have been. And then there's a records committee that will actually evaluate that to see if that's a verifiable sighting, because we're always interested in the odd things that may show up.
Yeah, Pat, you ought to do that. Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, please share that.
Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. I have a terrible problem with sapsuckers making holes. I have four beautiful Accolade elms that, of course, you know, I'm trying to save from Dutch elm disease. The bird has got, for some reason, these Accolades are favorite to them, and they're just peppered with holes. I don't think they're going deep enough into the cambrium layer of the tree. But basically, are they after a sap, or are they trying to draw ants to the holes, the sap?
Both. So is invertebrates, insects are attracted to that sap. Yeah, certainly they'll lap them up as protein, but they are tapping them for the sap itself, the sugars. Now, you have to consider that sapsuckers really are kind of a parasite. So they're bleeding that host and not hoping to kill it. I've got basswood trees, which seems to be another favorite of theirs, especially in springtime, that for year after year after year have been tapped by the sapsuckers. They're just riddled, but they don't kill the tree. Now, it's not to say that it can't happen, especially some of the thinner bark trees. I know for fruit trees, if they get on those, they can do enough damage if they go all the way around it to essentially girdle it and break through that cambium layer. They may kill a tree, but they're really just tapping it for that food, and they want to keep that tree alive. Just sometimes they get a little carried away. So, watch a little bit. It's an unusual tree, I think, for sapsuckers to be hitting, especially throughout the whole summer, but obviously you got a favorite for them. And, best you can do is just sit and watch and see if they're just simply taking advantage of the abundant sap for themselves and keeping the tree alive.
Yeah,
it's usually exceptional that they actually kill it. It's really unusual.
There you go, Lee. Thank you for calling. Janice in Antioch, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
We've had quite some experiences this summer, spring, with all kinds of bird adventures. We had Baltimore Orioles nesting somewhere nearby for the first time. And when we hung up the hummingbird feeders, they drip all the time. So we hung pie plates underneath and then put the grape jam inside that for the Orioles that came every day to nest. And we found that we also had the red-headed finch came in pairs and ate from the jam.
Yes,
and then this morning, we were really surprised. And there was always a pair. And then this morning, the barn swallows fledged off our porch. And 3 days ago, we found a dead one. We had been watching, and the mother was digging in the nest, pushing the babies around. And we found the dead one about an hour later that was being attracted. The flies were attracted to it. It must have been dead for a while to attract the flies that fast. And we're wondering if it was parasites that got it, like, you know, the bloodsucker thingies. And if we could have put in mothball flakes or something, would that have helped, or would they have taken them out?
Yeah, it's a little hard to try to intervene on that because you've got a mud nest. It's sometimes a little difficult to get in there and actually do something for any potential parasite. I guess, again, you have to look at it that the odds are they only lost one and they raised a pretty substantial family in spite of that. And that's pretty typical in nature. If you have something like a nest box, like a bluebird box, that we can check a little more regularly and people can look for the blowflies or parasites. But for most birds, it's a little hard to get in there. I think the best is just to sit and watch and hope for the best. And it sounds like, you know, the odds are that they actually did fairly well. Who knows what that cause of death is, whether it was a birth defect that it wasn't real healthy, whether it was a parasite load. Maybe it flew from the nest, had an accident. You know, that's always hard to determine.
Yep. Thank you very much, Janice, for calling. Tom in Cedarburg, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Another good show.
Thank you.
Hi. I
I've gotten interested in bird calling, and I found that almost any bird will respond, some a lot longer than others. You know, some may be, you know, just a few times back and forth, but some will go on for, boy, 20 minutes, half hour. One of my favorite birds to bird call with is called a peewee. And that one, it doesn't do it, you know, like every minute, but it'll be a pause for a minute or so, and it'll move to a different tree, and then it'll call again, and then move to a different tree and call again, and they always stay high. This weekend, I was up north by a lake, and there was a hunting bird, the small hawk, the kestrel, that I called to, boy, quite a few times, probably a total of 5 or 6 minutes or so. And this, the hunting birds are usually more quiet if they respond at all. But the kestrels, I find, are fairly friendly. And also the large hawks, the red-tailed hawks, will call too. The merlins, almost never. And obviously owls too. And I was wondering what your guest thinks about bird callers. Are they crazy or what?
All right, Tom.
Well, you know, birds will call primarily to establish a territory, so they're very vocal in spring, and, of course, then to attract the mate. So, one, they're calling one male after another, telling, look, this is my place, this is my claim, you go find your own nesting site, and then that to the female to announce to her he's got an available site, he's looking for a mate. And then once they begin the nest, birds may continue to sing, which biologists generally explain this as being the reinforcement of the pair bond. In other words, there's that commitment between the male and female to that nest site and raising the young. So they're basically staying together. They're keeping things going for the sake of the young to raise that family successfully. And what you'll notice then in springtime, the birds are going to be very active as they're both moving through and on their way to the nesting ground. They're starting to tune up and getting quite vocal. And that's all part of a hormone response. And then as they get into the nesting site, but as we get now into the middle of summer, things are quieting down. There's always going to be some occasional calling during the daytime, but a lot of it is just before sunrise. There's a little bit of activity, some chatter out there, and then it quiets down. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're just busy raising a family. They now have settled in. They don't need to attract the attention. The other fascinating thing to me is that as we get into late June and July, occasionally I will hear birds starting to sing around my house that haven't been here for a while. So, for example, I had wood thrush come through in spring, stop for a few days, beautiful song, seemed to move on, and then nothing for 3-4 weeks. And then all of a sudden one showed up and started singing. Had the same with a yellow-throated vireo. These are what we usually refer to as floaters. They're probably the unmated males or unsuccessful males. They found a place, were singing their hearts out, nobody responded, so they're now moving around. They're floating out there looking for some territory that isn't claimed and looking for a potential mate yet before the season comes to a close.
Yeah.
So, yep, the floaters are also out there singing away.
Well, I think Tyler's got a wood thrush song, and it is a pretty song.
Oh, Tyler, everybody's favorite, I think.
Yeah, Tyler, you want to play the... That's a pretty song, isn't it?
Yeah, people describe that as somewhat flute-like. Eole is the mnemonic for that, the way to remember it.
It's
and
great.
Up a little bit, there's a pause, then maybe rolling and down and a little trill in there. Yeah, it's really just a fascinating sound, almost eerie-like.
There it is.
They love the deep woods, and so larger contiguous forested sites like the Baraboo Hills, the Kettle Moraine, the southwestern part of the state, and they will nest into the northern part, but they're a little bit less common up there. They tend to be a little bit more replaced by the hermit thrush in northern Wisconsin.
Hmm. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network, taking a look at our birds and our nesting birds with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. Lots of online questions, lots of callers online. So You know what? I think we'll go right back to the phones. Terry in Willard, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a fan of the turkey vulture. I have an opportunity to watch him soaring quite a bit, and I think they make the bald eagle look like an amateur when they're soaring on the summer air currents, and I think you know, the idea that they just are scavengers and live on roadkill, I can't quite buy that. And there's got to be more to it, because that's not dependable, and it's, you know, it's just not that much. And how else do the birds survive? Do the turkey vultures survive?
Well, as far as I know, their diet is the carrion, the carcasses that they're feeding on. And they are what I refer to as nature's cleanup crew. And they also have a pretty strong stomach, because they can take some pretty decomposed food and take advantage of that. And, you know, always raises the question in my mind, so what is a bad meal to a vulture? But if you think about it, you say there's not that many car kills. I mean, there's things also dying in nature out in the woods that are unseen. It's not uncommon. Predators may leave parts behind. Something dies of disease or accident. Large carcasses like deer. We have about 45 to 50,000 deer a year hit on Wisconsin highways. You know, that's an awful lot of food. That would last a vulture or a good flock of them for quite some time. Raccoons, there's another pretty good size small mammal. And there's certainly no shortage of raccoons around. I think, if anything, we may not see the carcasses out there in the numbers that we would think support a vulture population. But just looking at the vultures, there's got to be plenty of food out there. Otherwise, there wouldn't be that many vultures. So they certainly find that quickly enough, and they clean things up.
What is a call like for a turkey vulture?
They're almost silent. About the only thing that you'll hear might be a hissing that they'll make at the nest site. And they nest on the ground for the most part, hollow logs or upturned trees. So they're looking for like a little cave. The Baraboo Hills, they're actually known to nest in actual rock crevices and caves. There was a survey of vulture nests. People said they found them under cabins where you have a somewhat raised floor, abandoned cabins and old sheds, wood piles. So anything that makes a bit of a nook for them is certainly where they take advantage. And they don't nest until they become adults, get that red head. So there's also a non-breeding cohort within the population, the young from last year.
Luann called to ask if we could play a Baltimore Orioles song. Tyler, have you got a Baltimore Orioles song that you can dig up for us?
Now, the Baltimore Oriole is a clear whistle, somewhat reminiscent of Robin, and this is where it can get confusing for people. So there's the chatter. You can hear that in the background. They'll throw that in there, too, which helps to distinguish them. But to me, it's a clearer whistle, not quite so slurred or rolling like a Robin. He's also more upbeat. There's an excitement in his voice, that you know, up and down. And to me, he's a bird with a positive attitude. So there's a lot of variation, by the way, of the song. So it's not a distinctive pattern, but it's that quality of the voice and that you know, if I say that sort of rolling and clear whistle and sort of a real happy bird, so to speak.
Yeah. Another listener called to thank Tyler for doing such a great job with the bird calls.
Absolutely. We appreciate that.
Probably a good time to mention the Cornell Lab as well, that website.
Yes. It's All About Birds. Is an excellent online website and field guide that people can use. So it's a quick reference. And the other thing you might want to consider is if you're looking for an online source or something on your phone, is it's through Cornell called Merlin, the Merlin website. And you can just go there and for free you can download the birds of the Eastern United States. There will be a quick field guide. You can play the different songs. They'll usually have one or two songs and a couple of calls of the bird, a nice picture, a range map. And there's even a tool on there where you can take a bird, either a photo or a description of it, and it'll try to match it up and give you an identification. So Merlin is really handy, and they're expanding that for all kinds of places around the world. I downloaded Merlin for the Atlantic coast of Brazil and for Nicaragua, so it's a really handy one. And the nice thing is that if you're doing some traveling is I may know the bird songs here, but when I get out of my home territory, it's all new stuff, and it's a nice reference because the look and a feel guide and have a description, you know, verbal description or the little sonogram trying to show you the pattern of the bird, it just doesn't communicate quite as well as just listening to it.
Yeah, for sure.
A couple of hints for people. Yeah, go to the All About Birds website and then download Merlin app. Very handy.
Steve in Boulder Junction, what's on your mind?
Oh, hello, Mr. Vogley mentioned that birds are blown off course. So they come from Central America, and they're blown all the way up here with some hurricane winds. What do they do when they get here? They're strangers in a strange land. Do they know enough to turn around and fly back home, or do they try to exist here, or what?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a bit of a mystery because we've got bird watchers all over the continent, and a lot of these people are very sharp to be able to identify these birds and to note them being there. So I mentioned earlier about the occurrence of a Lewis's woodpecker a few years ago out in La Crosse. It actually hung out for a while. It got there and figured, well, I'm not sure where I'm at, but I stuck around for a while. And what then happens is all of a sudden the bird just disappears. Now, the assumption is he probably figures it out and, you know, takes some cues from the environment and gets back on course. We've actually had some reports of very rare sightings. For example, on the East Coast, a bird may show up in, say, Connecticut, and then the same species is found again a few weeks later down coast. We assume it's the same individual moving around. We really don't know unless we mark them. But, yeah, that's always a mystery is, you know, they're here and then they're gone. I guess, you know, intuition would say, yeah, they finally figured out and get back to where they belong. And I would assume that that's probably true for most of them.
Yeah.
What brought them here in the first place and what takes them back to where they belong? You know, we really can't track them that accurately. So we really don't know, you know, they're here and then they're gone. But I think that's the kind of the fun of bird watching, the surprises of things that we'll see out there. And still the mysteries that even with the best science, things that we still don't completely understand or know.
Yeah, for sure. Nancy in Middleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. Thank you for your show. Around dusk, when the frogs start chirping, I hear a bird, and I just wonder if you might have any idea so I can maybe look up some possibilities, and it goes, ha, ha, ha. It's not like a crow, though. I can tell a crow. But I've only heard it at dusk.
At dusk.
Any ideas?
Hmm.
When it's getting dark. Ha, ha. And I can't think of any kind of animal it would be.
Possibly a young owl.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay. Because we've had an owl. I've heard a great horn here, and I looked up some owl sounds.
The young ones have a very distinctive call, and they'll do it well into late summer, early fall. A begging call.
Okay.
It's a little bit more of a kind of a wheezy screech. And barred owls are known for that, which is a common call.
Yeah.
They'll also make some other little screech or so. There are some other possibilities. I'm still working on the first one. A white bird. Yeah, if we get a recording, I could certainly help you a little more with it. But again, you may want to check on the All About Birds and listen to a few of the possibilities.
Okay.
I'll take a look at it there. That's something might give you a little bit of a hint, too.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
Thanks for testing us.
And Amy in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love the show. So I've had bluebirds nesting successfully in a box for 2 years. Last year, towards the end of the season, I saw sparrows kind of going to the box, and every time I would chase them away. this year, the sparrows, even though the bluebirds were there and I tried to scare the sparrows away, the sparrows must have taken over that nest. Am I supposed to go into that nest and take those eggs out and then think that maybe the bluebirds are going to re-go in there? Should I be harassing the sparrows? I don't know what to do now for my bluebirds.
Okay, good question. There are a couple of options here. One, you may want to try to put a second nest box up to give a little chance for birds in one box to raise a family while others are distracted somewhere else. You may also want to check the website for the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. And there are a number of good hints of box construction, the design, the placement, the monitoring of the box. And it's not necessarily for everyone, but they do strongly advocate the removal of house sparrows because they are a serious competitor.
Yeah.
Chasing them away, you know, as soon as you turn your back, they're going to be back again.
They're going to be right back again. Bill Volkert, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about birds with birding expert Bill Volkert today on the show. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Bill's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He is also a federally licensed master bird bander with the Bird Banding Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send a photo and or a question via email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, Bill, we had a photo. I don't know if you can see it. Jane emailed
it. Yes,
mm-hmm. Yeah, a photo of a nest, wondering what it is.
Yeah, this is a vireo nest and probably red-eyed vireo. A couple of the species make a somewhat similar nest. The red-eyed is probably the more common widespread of the vireos. And the telltale characteristics are that it's built in a fork. It's suspended from the fork of the tree and usually a little bit of white in there. Sometimes they'll find little paper scraps or paper birch, the bark, and weave that into it. And that is very typical of the red-eyed vireo nest. So yeah, that's a pretty easy one to identify. And, Jill has been really nice to be able to share those pictures, and I'll even try to answer some of those questions after the show if people want to email in if we can't get to them all. Yeah, we hear red-eyed vireo there.
Let's hear that again, Tyler. Another pretty song. They're all pretty to me, though. They all
Well, this one is something you really need to identify by its song. Red-eyed vireo is a relatively nondescript bird, about halfway the size between, say, a sparrow and robin, or a little bit larger than sparrow. He's one of the larger of the vireos. It's got a greenish olive back, somewhat whitish underneath. It's just a stripe above the eye, and then the red eye, which you need to have good lighting to see. But they're a bird of the middle and upper part of the forest canopy. And especially now in middle of summer, the leaves are full, and a little 5-inch bird hiding way up in the treetop, you're going to have a hard thing. It's a very diagnostic song. And as we heard, it's somewhat interrupted. The mnemonic for that is, here I am, where are you? Says a little, and a little more. Always a pause, or as I think of it, as ambulance, sort of. So what do you think? I don't know. Should we go? Yeah, we could. So that's the ribbon pattern, and that's a very, very good way to recognize the bird is by the pattern.
This one looks like it's on the side of a house or garage or something.
Yeah,
very
surprising, because usually we're back in the trees, but they'll build them in all kinds of places.
Joe in Kokana, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hello, you were speaking of the ability of buzzards, turkey buzzards, turkey vultures to soar. Mm-hmm. And a number of years back, I read in a scientific magazine, there was an article about how nature has implemented some of the things that we implement when we construct things.
Oh, yeah.
And the broad bone in the wings of that vulture is actually pretty darn close to triangulation that we use in building bridges and beams.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it a hollow bone so that that bone structure of the bird is so light that it excels even more so with the soaring.
Well, you're right. I mean, birds taught us to fly. And the vultures tend to hold their wings up a little bit at an angle, or what we refer to as a dihedral. And so they're catching the updrafts. They don't have to flap their wings very much if there's a warm day and rising air currents. And that saves an awful lot of energy. They can just soar all day long without expending any energy until they finally come upon food. And typical of birds of prey, which I guess even eating dead things, it kind of qualifies them as that. You don't get a meal necessarily every day. So when they do, they'll gorge themselves. And that dihedral, by the way, it also helps when it's a little windy or gusty, because if they tip to one side, the wing that's now laying out is flatter, gets more lift, and brings them back around again. So it's almost like being on a pendulum that he's hanging up there in the wind. And yeah, very efficient flyers, aren't they?
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the information and the call. Judy in Racine, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Bill. You are awesome. When that woman called in, when the woman called in about the sound that she couldn't identify and you weren't sure about,
yeah, help me out, please.
Call in because I hear that same sound in the morning when I walk my dog, and it's up high and it's, you know, easy to hear. So I'm waiting to see what that is. Would you hear an owl in the morning?
Oh, you know, they may call at any time, but right now they're out, they're young, and, you know, it's pretty intermittent that they're going to call. I'm trying to think what else with that kind of description for it.
That's a hard one.
I'm drawing
one.
A blank, yeah.
Judy, thanks.
Maybe somebody else has got a better idea than what I'm coming up with here.
There we go. Carolyn and Holman, your turn. Hi. Carolyn.
Hi. I was calling to respond to the question earlier about being able to identify a bird sound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was able to find an app called Smart Bird ID, and it has a portion of it that you can record the sound, and it will give you a list of possible birds.
Oh, okay. So it's comparing it with some of the recordings there. Oh, excellent.
Oh,
yes.
Smart.
Smart Bird ID. Occasionally you have to watch a little video quick, or you could pay for it, but I was able to identify, I was unable to identify a certain sound, and it turned out to be mourning dove wing chatter. And I hit so I did that,
and it recorded it.
Yeah, it was a sound I hadn't heard before, but it was in the trees, and so I was able to use that. And we've used it on a couple other occasions to identify a bird. So, yeah, you can record the sound, and it'll give you a list of possible birds.
Very cool. Smart Bird ID app. And you can get a free version or probably pay a buck or two to get the version that doesn't contain the sort of ads or promotions.
Well, with the emerging technology, eventually they're going to make it easier and easier for people, and it's not going to take you decades to try to learn and remember all those bird songs the way I had to do it the hard way.
Thanks again, Carolyn. Kathy in Racine, we're on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you guys? Thank you so much for your show here today.
Sure.
I have two questions. The first one is IDing a feather. I was cutting the grass a few days ago, and I found a feather just laying in the middle of the yard, and it was about 9 inches long, tip to tip. Mm-hmm. And it was brown with a little bit of tan on it. And I wasn't sure exactly what that was. I was thinking maybe an owl, but I don't know. It was just in the middle of the yard. And is there something, a site or anything we could go to?
I do have a really good book reference on feathers. There must be something online. I still use things out of my library. If you have it handy, you could take a photo and just email that. And I'll certainly take a look at it. The first thing we got to do is look at the shape of the feather to see if it's a wing feather or tail feather, whether it's from the outer part of the wing or the inner part, and then the color pattern on it. So, the mottled brown, the more common ones, now owls, hawks, pheasant, those are some of the birds that tend to have that kind of a pattern to them.
Yeah,
I thought it was a hawk.
Color.
Yeah, could have been a hawk. Well, if you've still got to take a photo of it and send it in to ideas@wpr.org.
Okay,
and
great.
See if we can get it identified. Thank you, Kathy.
Wait, I got one more question. Is that I have me and my neighbors have bird feeders, and it seems as though that this time of the year, early spring, we get these black birds with a little bit of brown shimmer on them. They've called them cowbirds, but they're like pigs, and they try to. Is that what it is?
Yeah, brown-headed cowbird. That's the male with that brown head. The female is all grayish, but she has a very similar head and beak shape, a very conical little beak. Those are nest parasites, so they will lay their eggs in other birds' nests to raise the family. And, the blackbirds, these can be a problem around feeders. I've got feeders where the red-winged blackbirds and grackles come in, and they'll clean it out three times as fast as any of the other birds would do it. And that becomes a bit of a decision. Do you want to spend the time and money to feed a few birds that are really becoming gluttons at your feeders, or do you want to just shut it down and wait? Because really at this time of year, you know, not only are bird populations at their peak, but so is food in nature. So it's like a drive-thru, like a fast food. They don't need it. It's convenient, though. They'll take advantage of it. So it's not like, say, in wintertime where during severe winter weather and storms where it actually can help birds kind of get through. And they're a little bit more attracted when foods are in short supply.
Yeah.
So, you may want to just shut it down if they're really making pigs of themselves and costing you too much money and just wait.
Yeah. There you go, Kathy. Thank you. Norm in Oneida County. On to you now. Hi, Norm. Whoop, we lost Norm. That's okay. Melissa emailed to ask where hummingbirds typically nest and if they're consistent. She'd love to catch sight of a nest someday as hummingbirds frequent her feeders very regularly. Recently, she was taking the feeder down to change the food, and a little guy came up and ate in her hand, and it was amazing for her. So where the nesting itself, they're tough to see.
They are about the size of, say, like a 50-cent piece. It's a tiny nest. I mean, you're talking about maybe the size of a golf ball. And they will glue it to a branch using plant fiber, spider web, and then they'll paste on the outside little bits of lichen. So it looks like little more than just a natural bump on a twig. And so to find something that small and that well camouflaged, it basically takes good luck. Now, some people have suggested that if you want to look for it, sit by your feeder, and if the birds are coming and going, watch which way the hummingbirds are going. If they're always going in one direction, and this could take a little while, then move down in that direction and see if you can kind of track them back if they're going always to one site to, say, feed the young. That could take a little while, and even then you're going to have to peer to find it. Usually those nests will be, from my experience, about, say, 15 to 25 feet up. They're usually not real high. They may come back to the same place, the nest, again. A friend of mine I was talking to recently said that he's got hummingbirds back on the same tree that they were last year. So I guess if it worked for them, they'll try it again.
Yeah.
But, to find something that small, it's not only a real joy to find it, but it's also good luck.
Very good luck.
Great job of hiding those, yeah.
I found one, just happened to see it coming out of the bush and took a close look and found one. And you're right, it's not very big. We had a listener email to ask if robins sweep a leaf over eggs to cool them.
No, they don't. Nothing that I know of. Now, birds have a pretty high body temperature to begin with. Most of them are around 102 to 105. So even on what are pretty warm days for us, if they leave the nest during the day and feed and just rest in the shade themselves, those eggs probably aren't going to be cooking because they'll be in its temperature in the shade. They're not going to be laying them right out in the open. Nest boxes, they can get quite warm, but, you know, good wood is usually a fair insulator, just like a hollow tree. I know that a number of years ago, people were looking for a cheap, easy way for building wood duck boxes. They suggested using plastic pails, but abandoned that because they heated up too quickly. So usually, yeah, they really don't do anything. If it starts to cool down, of course, the female incubates them, and she will lose some of the down feathers on her breast and then pull up that body contour feather that we call it, so she can lay that skin right on the eggs and keep them nice and warm. And they won't begin to incubate until the clutch is complete. So they'll lay an egg every day or two, and when they have enough eggs in there, then she'll start to incubate, so they all hatch on the same time.
Hmm. Another comment relating to feathers. Carol in Racine has something in that line. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Hi, Bill. This is Carol Howard calling.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. I just wanted to mention another app for doing song, for one thing. It's called BirdNet. It's similar to the one the other woman mentioned. And then there's another app called iNaturalist, which you can take a picture, and it will identify flowers, insects, or feathers for you, or at least give you
options. I've heard of, though I've never used it.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
And maybe,
yeah,
I didn't know, maybe you mentioned
there, isn't there?
It, I didn't hear you. Yeah, so that woman
right.
from Racine can do that.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate
okay.
the hint.
Thanks.
Thanks for sharing with me.
Yeah, thank you. iNaturalist, that's
yeah.
the app. Well, we have to look that one up, too.
They're probably coming out with something new every week. It's hard to keep up, but it is getting better and better all the time.
Chris in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a robin that I had flying into the windows of my house for about 6 weeks. So it was...
Oh, yeah.
Yep, after the nesting, I put plastic up. I put blue tape across the windows, try to exit out, but it continued just bombarding the windows day and night.
Yeah, that can be very annoying, and it's almost like a neurotic behavior for the bird. Becomes quite obsessive. It's what I would call shadow boxing. He's seeing his reflection in the window, he thinks it's a competitor, so he flies up into the window, tries to chase that bird away, turns away. It's like, okay, I got him out of my territory. Turns around and God darn, there he is again. So, yeah, they will get really obsessed with that. And, of course, for the occupant of the house, it can get to be a real problem. Hard to break a bird of a habit like that once they get going. The best to do is when you first hear the birds doing that, get on it right away and see if you can't discourage them. As you say, cover up the window, try something like that. I've had birds, you cover up one window, they go around the corner and find another one. And it's not always easy. It's not always successful. And especially for people who work during the day, you get out in the morning, you try to chase the bird away. Well, he's got all day to obsess over his own reflection. So, yeah, it can be a problem, and especially in that early part of the nesting season. You said 6 weeks, which is a long time to have to put up with it. Plus, for a fairly good-sized songbird like a robin, you've also got the mess of the droppings then all over the edge of the window or the deck nearby or whatever. It's one of those things that if you can break them of the habit and intervene early, early intervention is always important. It can work, but not in all cases.
But Connie,
that's what living with birds is, right?
Connie emailed that to keep sapsuckers from her trees, she puts up peanut feeders. And seems to give the sapsuckers like the peanuts, I guess.
Give them an alternative food source.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's something worth trying.
And then relating to that vibrating bird, and I've thought of this myself, Anastasia and Carolyn each emailed that they think the vibrating bird may be a dove. I thought of that.
There's a possibility, yeah. Yep.
It's... it's possible. Heather and Eau Claire emailed that she had a pair of robins nest on her front porch this spring. After the babies left the nest, another nest was made in her crabapple tree, and those babies have left the nest, and now it's empty. Now robins are building a nest on top of the floodlight fixture on her garage. Could this be? She wonders if this is the same pair, and how many broods will they raise in a season? Also, do songbirds make a new nest each time?
Oh, good question. Yeah, for songbirds, some of them will reuse a nest. So like my phoebes and bluebirds, for example, they'll go back into the same nest once they've raised a family. Some birds may move to a different nest, and they can, you know, for some birds, they can build them pretty quickly. Is it the same robin? Well, a little hard to say. I mean, they all look alike, so it's hard to distinguish them that way. If the nests are really close together from one site to the next, you're probably within that same pair's territory. So likely that it is. If there's some distance, it may be one bird raised its family and they fledged and another one's moved in quickly at the edge of that territory. But that's always the trick is unless we have a way to actually capture and mark birds to distinguish individuals, it's hard to know who's who out there. It's, all the robins yeah. will look alike, right?
They do indeed. Jim in Oshkosh emailed that several weeks ago he noticed a green heron nesting 20 feet up in a tree in his neighborhood and subsequently observed four chicks. This was not near any water except a small intermittent stream. He thought herons would nest in the marsh. It's unusual for them to be up in a tree like this?
Well, they're going to look for a nice dense cover. Usually a spruce tree is pretty common, or a dense willow, somewhere where they can tuck it away. It's about the size of a crow nest, and they can do a pretty good job of hiding those. I've had them nesting right above one of my trails where I hardly knew it until I heard the young croaking up there and doing little grunts. Now there's that skill, the throaty little call. But they will fly quite a distance for feeding. So if there's water somewhat nearby, they'll make a bit of a flight, you know, say a quarter, half mile or more to go out and feed. And you have to remember, for some of these birds, they're oftentimes just like fishermen, trying different areas. So it's, you know, if there's a couple of sites nearby, they may try one place in, you know, 1 hour and then go somewhere else, just like you might when you're fishing, right?
I move quickly.
Not biting, you know, go somewhere else. The same thing. The heron will spend about so much time at a place. If there's no luck, they'll move on and try something else. And they can move quite a bit from a nest site to try to find enough food for all those young, especially four young. That's quite a family to keep fed and get out of the nest.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I have to tell you, Bill, this is always such a pleasure to have you with us. And I really appreciate you taking the time. And I hope we have a chance to do this again very soon. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for asking. And I'm just glad to see that people are watching birds and enjoying them. I mean, if we're at least aware of the birds being out there, I think that helps people to become a little bit more concerned about helping them out and providing some good habitat for them and caring for the birds. They certainly depend on us these days.
Yeah,
I appreciate everybody's interest in birds.
Look forward to your next visit. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years. He's been watching birds a long time. He's now sighted and identified 3,900 bird species personally. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Well, I'll tell you what, that was fun. Wednesday, we'll talk about recent wildlife observations and do a roundup of the spring turkey harvest with Jamie Knack and David Drake. In the meantime, hey, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.